From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The burbs are back. In fact, suburbs are more popular than ever. Over half of all Americans now live there. And a new kind of suburb is emerging in this high-tech age. Ironically, cyberspace is making it possible.
The more people can choose where to live, they're going to choose those places they want to live. So the characteristics of place, which we thought would become less important, have become more important.
This hour, why the old arguments between suburbs and cities don't hold up anymore. Also, a remarkable story of urban renewal. When Ken Reardon first went to East St. Louis, he discovered a city that looked like a war zone.
All the street signs were stolen for their salvage value. 1,000 manhole covers were stolen. So around one elementary school in the middle of a neighborhood that we began our work in 1990, there were approximately 135 manhole covers missing. And think about our children navigating those kinds of treacherous urban conditions. It was just horrifying.
So what do you do in a place like this? In East St. Louis, the answer came from an unusual collaboration between grassroots leaders and college students.
Another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Charcoal burning everywhere. Rows of houses that are all the same, and no one seems to care.
It's not a pretty picture we get of the suburbs. They're boring. Mindless places, we're told, with cookie-cutter houses that all look the same. And suburban culture, well, there isn't any, except what you find at the local mall. But, you know, if those stereotypes are true, why do so many Americans choose to live in suburbia? City planner Tom Martinson has spent most of his life there, and he told Steve Paulson it's a great place to live. Martinson makes a spirited defense of suburbia in his book American Dreamscape.
The bottom line of it is, why do you live in a certain place? What is it that makes you happy? Now, for some people, living in a city with museums and high-rises makes them happy, and that's terrific. For other people, living in a tiny town with just neighbors and friends around makes them happy. Suburbs are something else. Obviously, when you see the number of people who are moving to the suburbs, over half of all Americans now live there. And when you read the polls, which almost universally among, you know, when they poll suburbanites, do you like living where you do? They have very, very high positives in that. You have to assume that they're getting what they want. It may not be a museum on the corner. However, even that is changing. If you look around, you see even high culture is filtering out into suburbia. You look at things like, well, take the Getty Villa Museum in Malibu, obviously a suburb of L.A. If you're looking at L.A. again, maybe to me the best museum is Norton Simon. That's in Pasadena. If you look at our great colleges and universities, think of names like Harvard, Stanford, and Berkeley. They're all in suburbs. All of these big city institutions, and if you count shopping, for example, and even restaurants, have moved out into the suburbs almost universally.
I was surprised to learn in your book that this has not always been the reputation of suburbs. Before World War II, really before Levittown, the suburbs had a great reputation among urban planners and architects.
Yeah, isn't that a fascinating thing? Way into the 20th century, the assumption was that a two-part city, as Sam Bass Warmer describes Boston, is the ideal, a place to work and a place to live. And that sort of meant, since all of the manufacturing and stuff was in the downtowns or the center of the core, that whether you were in the municipality or outside, the suburban experience was where everyone wanted to live. Then you had, since that was a high expectation, you had all of the greatest architects, landscape architects, planners were working on the suburban problem. That went all the way up through the war. And I'm talking now the Second World War. Mm-hmm. However, in the post-war period, don't even know how to explain it, but all of a sudden the tastemakers were saying that suburbs are bad, just the things we were talking about before. They're banal and people who live there can't be too bright.
You're really talking about the intellectuals.
The intellectuals. But this, of course, is what you, this is what informs the media. This is what informs the sort of sense of the country. So what happened for that reason, for others, the best of our designers, in most cases, went to work on large-scale projects, non-residential projects, downtown projects. And by the way, I'm not criticizing them. I would have done the same thing at the time. And what's happened then, that we've had a whole different type of group of professionals who have been doing suburbs. They've been technically competent, but not necessarily visionary. And one of the reasons then that we do not have, in my opinion, suburbs as good as they could be is simply because we've been missing that creativity and imagination that was so clear in forming the suburbs prior to the war.
I want to play you an excerpt from an interview we did with one prominent critic of suburbia. He's James Kunstler, the author of The Geography of Nowhere, which I think sums up his take on this. And here's that bit of tape.
The suburbs will prove to be, in the next 25 years, an experiment that has failed. The classic automobile auto-dependent suburb is going to be viewed as an experiment that has failed. And this suggests that we are going to need a new blueprint for living in this country. We are going to have to return to some traditional patterns that we once knew how to do splendidly well, which we have either forgotten or thrown away. For example, the urban neighborhood, the classic small town, the rural village. Well, fortunately, there is a significant movement in this country, and it goes under the name of the New Urbanism, which is promoting the return to traditional principles of town planning and of building an everyday environment that really allows people to live happily and to have a civic life.
Okay, I'm guessing that you would not agree with that assessment.
If you look back at critics of the suburbs, and they've been few but loud in the last 40 years, they have always said that in the next 25 years, the next 10 years, the next generation, that the suburbs, nobody will like them anymore, the suburbs will be a failure in this case, he says, and others have said the same thing. Well, you know, this has been going on now for much longer than these predictions, and it isn't happening.
Well, this movement that he's talking about, the new urbanism, has been touted as the savior of urban planning. I mean, the idea is that fewer people want to live in the cities now. The suburbs are bankrupt, and so we need something else. And so there's this group of architects and designers who are trying to create something new, these very attractive sort of small-town environments.
Well, of course, they're not. The one thing to understand here when you're talking about tradition doesn't mean to me, if I'm looking at American tradition, does not mean going back and copying something old. If you look at what's traditional about America, it's innovation. Whether the small town, whether the downtown, whether the prairie development, and what I think is lacking in here in this new urbanism is no innovation.
So the solution is not to bring back the front porch or to have alleys in back of the houses where you put the cars. And of course, the idea of the front porch is where people will be sitting out there and getting to know their neighbors, and the streets will be sort of small so cars can't go racing through there. You're saying that's not the solution.
Well, it's obviously so trivial. It doesn't deal with big issues like transportation and jobs and economics, et cetera. If you think that things are not good, or if you think that things could be better, which has always been the case in the U.S. and elsewhere too, then you try and come up with a new creative solution. This is not to me. I mean, this is like the bonbon at the end of a long dinner.
So why do you think people are so drawn to live in the suburbs? I mean, in spite of all the criticism from, as you would say, the intellectuals, more than half the country now lives in suburbs. What's the great attraction?
Oh, there's several. The main one after the war was that it was available. There was no real places to live in the city compared to the number of the growing population. Developments were occurring in the suburbs, and they weren't in the city, A. B, the ones in the suburbs were actually much less expensive to live in. You did initially have a little more cost in driving your car, but they were much less expensive. The third thing is that a lot of Americans, not all but many, like a little piece of land of their own. Doesn't have to be an estate, but it has to be something of their own, their home, and they aren't going to be happy living in an apartment. Fourth, and maybe the most important, I think, is that there's a suburban state of mind. And the suburban state of mind, at its worst, is sort of leave me alone. But you can kind of understand that. There's a sense if you live in a big city, there's all kinds of rules, there's all kinds of hierarchies, and a lot of Americans, again, I can't say all, but many Americans tend to not react well to that. So the idea of being in a decentralized suburb, a little bit of space of your own, not so expensive, people leave you alone, makes a lot of people happy.
Now, one of the difficulties of this conversation is the danger of generalizing, and there are lots of different kinds of suburbs out there, and I'm willing to bet that you would say there are better suburbs and worse suburbs, and I'm curious about what you see as the best kind of suburb, if you could point to a few examples.
If you were talking about what's a beautiful suburb from a visual standpoint, then I look at pre-war, actually 19th century suburbs like Llewellyn Park outside of New York, just gorgeous houses sitting on kind of a vast estate. Riverside is one of the most celebrated right next to Chicago. After the war, to me, the very best is the Woodlands, which is north of Houston. It's based totally, almost totally on the landscape as opposed to architecture, and it's wonderful. It's actually a whole town. It's like a new town. It was developed in the 1970s and designed by a very well-known landscape architect, Ian McHarg. The idea of that was to, A, base the town on landscape as opposed, as I mentioned, to architecture. And
so what does the landscape look like?
There's two things about it. One is they haven't, there was sort of a piney woods there, and instead of a lot of subdivisions, they just cut everything down and start over again. They cut the neighborhoods into the woods, which is, of course, really wonderful. The other thing which was very exciting was that McHarg took some really functional things. One of the big planning issues was something real mundane, flood control. And he took these facilities, like holding ponds and arroyos, and made them into just beautiful features, water features. So people go by and say, gee, this is just absolutely glorious. Actually, it's plumbing. But the ability to work with the land and do something innovative out of the functional requirements is one of those things I think is such an American characteristic, that we always come up with unexpected solutions when these new problems present themselves. So in both ways, Woodlands, to me, is just a paradigm of the American ideal.
Tom Martinson is a city planner and urban historian who lives outside of Minneapolis. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, American Dreamscape, The Pursuit of Happiness in Post-War Suburbia.
Well, we all live in East Longmeadow, and we live in a house just like all the others. Water my lawn till it's green. My wife has a garden, she grows beans, and we all live in East Longmeadow. Well, I drive every day down to Hartford. I got me a job in a skyscraper. I wear a jacket, I wear a tie, I sell insurance. I'm a nice guy, so we can live in East Longmeadow.
Coming up, a new kind of suburb for the high-tech age, the Nerdistan. Also, Eric Bogosian's apocalyptic fable about shopping malls. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You might figure the high-tech revolution would have no impact on the geography of cities and suburbs. And after all, cyberspace is an ethereal place. You only need a laptop to get there. But social critic Joel Kotkin, in his book The New Geography, says e-commerce has had a profound effect on where people live. He told Ann Strainchamps it's created a new kind of freedom.
The more people can choose where to live, they're going to choose those places they want to live. So the characteristics of place, which we thought would become less important, have become more important. So what really matters now is not so much whether or not you're located on an interstate or whether or not you're located in necessarily an area that has access to raw materials or a natural harbor. The things that really matter are the sort of quality of life considerations, which bring different kinds of information age workers to a particular location. So in a way, it sort of repealed geography in a way that the Industrial Revolution had done 100 years ago.
So where are people choosing to live? Are you discovering that as people can live anywhere, the knowledge workers, information experts, are choosing to live in similar places?
In the book, I talk about three kinds of places I've done particularly well. One is what you would call the primary area, what I call nerdistans. That is the sort of sterile, if you will, peripheral suburbs that have developed around cities. But they're not like the old suburbs. They tend to be almost all made up of upper income and upper middle class people. They tend to be well planned. They have parks. It's very safe for SUVs. It's the kind of place that people who don't want any surprises in life. And what I find is that the hard side of the technology revolution, the, if you will, the nerds, the scientists, the people who are creating the enabling software, the people who are the most interested in sort of scientific work, in the sort of building the pipeline, if you will, they love the nerdistans. North Dallas, Irvine, California, places like Raleigh, Durham. These are classic nerdistans. The second place that's done really well is what you would call the boutique city, which is the urban area that attracts a different person. That person tends to be single, could be gay, could be a couple without children, could be somebody who's divorced, who wants to be around the action. This tends to attract more the creative types.
So what's a boutique city?
Santa Monica, San Francisco, Boston are prime cases, Seattle. They tend to be smaller cities or more compact areas. Manhattan, if you took it by itself. They're places where, first of all, many cases you can walk. There's a lot of single people. There are a lot of, if you will, very attractive people. There's a lot going on in the arts community, in culture. But the big thing is that in the old days, we used to call gentrification. You know, people work downtown. They'd live in nice neighborhoods. And sometimes they'd move 10, 15, 20 minutes away to be close to work. What you have now is something really different, is that the people either work from home or work in these neighborhoods. Take Lower Manhattan. Lower Manhattan has been gentrified, but what it's been gentrified in is a change of the employment base, where you used to have printers and meat cutters and warehousemen working in Lower Manhattan. Now you have, in the same places, graphic artists, internet companies, design firms, advertising agencies. So now these areas are not just warehouses for upper-income workers. They have now become wealth creation neighborhoods themselves. And again, you see this in Chicago, in Bucktown, in Wicker Park, and several other parts of Chicago.
You said there's a third kind of place.
Well, the third kind of place is what I call the Valhallas. And, of course, Valhalla is taken from Norse mythology, you know, where you went after, you know, dying gloriously in battle.
Paradise.
Right. And you know, where they get to fight battles over and over again and then wake up and have a, you know, a few good shots of whatever they were drinking. The reality of Valhallas is that they used to be almost like vacation communities. Park City, Utah, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Cape Cod, various sort of places on lakes and in mountain areas, some places on the coast. If you can go anywhere, if you're running an investment bank and 80% of your business is really being done back and forth on the internet, you really don't have to be in Manhattan. You don't have to be in even downtown Denver.
Right. So why not live in Aspen?
Park City. Well, that's what they do. And that's why Aspen is now the most expensive place in America to live. And what, 20 years ago, Aspen was a bunch of hippy dippies, right? I mean, it was not, you know, and skiers. You look at Park City, Utah, a dying town. It was an old silver mining town. It was dying. It was almost a ghost town 30 years ago. It became a ski resort. It now has higher real estate prices than Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. So what the digital revolution has done is empowered people to go live in places that they want to live and actually still function in the economy. And that wasn't really possible before.
So this sounds like a nice life if you can get it.
It's a wonderful life if you can get it. But there's a dark side to this whole picture. Let's take the three types of areas. Nerdistans do well, but older suburbs, what I call in the book the Midopolis, old 1950s vintage suburbs, that sort of cookie cutter construction, beginning to sort of go a little bit to seed, two bedroom, one bath houses that yuppies won't live in. These areas, in many cases, are declining. So there were winners in the nerdistans and sometimes losers in the Midopolis. You take a look in the cities. Sure, it's been a great decade for Boston, for Manhattan, for Chicago, for Seattle, for San Francisco. Not been such a great 10, 15 years for Buffalo, for Detroit. After all, if you can work and live anywhere, why would you choose Detroit? And then in the countryside, it's really interesting because whereas the attractive areas in the Rocky Mountains and in the Appalachians, some places have done really well, and on the coasts and in where there are lakes and forests, you go out to the upper Midwest and the parts of the Great Plains that are not particularly attractive, and these places are dying. Hmm. 1/3 of all the small towns in Iowa probably won't exist 20 years from now.
I wanted to go back and talk a little bit more about the Nerdistans, because that, of the three places you're describing, in some ways the Nerdistan is the newest thing that we're seeing?
Yes.
Or what's new about the Nerdistan? For instance, how is the Nerdistan different from the typical suburb that many of us grew up in?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's something I've done a lot of thinking about. The difference between a Nerdistan and a suburb, and of course, you know, there's always a little blending of everything. First of all, suburbs were really built for everybody. You would have a suburban expansion, let's say, where I grew up on Long Island, and there were working-class suburbs, and there were middle-class suburbs, and then there were the enclaves of the rich. But they all sort of coexisted within the same area. What you have now with Nerdistans is areas where basically, the entire economy is based on high-end information businesses. They don't want manufacturing anywhere around. They don't want warehouses. They don't want Kmart. They don't want Walmart. They really want to create an environment that is really for the, if you will, the aristocracy of the information age. They also are using planning much more. And it's sort of an odd confluence between planning, environmentalism, which is strong in these areas, and the desire to create elite high-tech communities. So if you go to a place like a Raleigh-Durham or a Irvine, California, things are actually very well planned. There are lots of little parks. There are good schools. Things sort of make sense. And what's really interesting is high-tech companies and high-end developers are coming to the conclusion, you know, this works. People are looking for this. You know, because you think about it today. You take your average high-end information age workers living out in the suburbs at the fringe of town. The company is there. Their kids are going to school there. That's one of the biggest reasons why they're there. Downtown really doesn't matter to them. They don't go into the city maybe more than once every 2-3 months. So where do they shop? Where do they hang out? Where do they go even to a repertory theater? Is out in the Nerdistan in a little town center. And they like it. And I think you're very correct. I think a lot of people are looking for not recreating suburbia as we experienced it in the 60s and 70s and even the 50s, is to create an ersatz small town experience, which is qualitatively different than the experience that traditional suburbs gave.
Yeah, what's interesting is that thinking about community, this really does create a kind of catch-22 in that I'm sure these are really lovely communities, and people probably feel safe and comfortable and so can really come together and give their kids the kind of outdoor upbringing that they want, in which kids can just, you know, hang out at the neighborhood park and everybody feels safe. And on the other hand, there's no diversity. It's a community made up of a whole pile of people who are exactly like each other.
That's exactly right. Even more than the old suburbs in some ways. Because in the old suburbs, it was still nearby. Maybe your suburb was upper middle class, but the one next to it was working class. And the one next to it was, you know, largely African American or Latino. Now, these people are completely cut off from the closest heavily Latino community, let's say, to Westlake Village, is probably a good 10, 12 miles away. One of the things that these communities have, they have terrible trouble getting help. They can't get people to work in the stores because the kids are in the classes and all the other activities. There's nobody to work retail. So you go into one of these malls and it's every other store is help wanted, help wanted, help wanted. So there's a kind of disconnect, and these places are becoming more and more disconnected from the community around them. People who live in Nerdistans don't really relate to the region that they're in, except maybe they use the airport and they might root for the football team.
Joel Kotkin is a senior fellow at Pepperdine University's Davenport Institute for Public Policy. He talked with Ann Strainchamps about his book, The New Geography.
I'm white. I grew up in the suburbs. I like to use adverbs to show I went to school.
Absolutely, I totally, really, truly do.
All right. Maybe I am a little, I don't know, corny. a little square, a little boring. Just give me a break and say I'm cool. I was raised on mashed potatoes, little tiny hamburgers. We were afraid the neighbors would hate us, so we'd never sound perturbed. All right.
Leave it to playwright and actor Eric Bogosian to dream up something truly weird. Bogosian is the creator of such explosive theater pieces as Talk Radio and Suburbia. His solo shows include Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, and Pounding Nails in the Floor with My Forehead. And now he's written his first novel. It's called Mall. It's an over-the-top satire about a few people who converge one day in a shopping mall. A dead-end teenager, a randy housewife, a voyeuristic businessman, and a speed freak named Mal, who heads to the mall with a sack full of weapons and dreams of an apocalypse. Steve Paulson wanted to know why Bogosian set this story in a shopping mall.
I think malls are typical of the way we live today and the way I live. I end up at the mall quite often. I have two boys who need to get their sneakers and jackets for school. And when I find myself walking around this highly contrived and constructed environment, supposedly pleasant, I find it kind of like it sort of takes the air out of my lungs. And I wonder if anybody else feels this way. And I wanted to write about the way we live today. I come from the suburbs originally, and I was sort of one of the first mall rats in the whole world, because the Burlington Mall, which was one of the first big malls, was built right near my house in the late 60s, and I hung out there a lot.
Well, it's interesting that you're saying this, because clearly the mall is not a good place in this story, and it would seem that the larger target in your novel is suburbia, suburban living. But you're saying that's not just about other people, that you're part of that culture as well.
Yes, I spend about a quarter of my time in an area it's actually the correct term is exurban, which is that it's a little bit past the suburbs. But I do go to the Kmarts and the fast foods and the Wendy's and all that stuff. In fact, I know from my own experience it's kind of a relief when you're in those environments, because you know where everything is and everything's very predictable. For me, it's a break from something a little more chaotic living in New York City. And I guess that's why I wonder about it, because I know that people live in this environment all the time, and I don't know how they don't just go mad. But I think that's what American culture is dealing with today, is how do we live within this corporate culture. For instance, I mean, when you go to the airport, you stand in line. Everybody has to stand in line. Some corporate entity is deciding how long that line should be. If the line is too short, it's not efficient. If the line is too long, somebody starts going crazy and attacking the people behind the counter. They don't want that to happen either. So, you know, we are being manipulated. It's not an organic thing. It's something that somebody somewhere has decided this is the way we need to live.
Do you worry about lapsing into cliches about suburbia? That it's
They're not cliches for me. I think that we live in a role-playing society where we are our own behavior is modulated by what we think is expected of us. And when I live in the mall world, I behave as a mall person. The only problem is that people, unlike whatever the planners are thinking about when they first put these places together, are not predictable and are fueled by deep, deep urges, and that you don't know where those things are going to take anybody. I mean, there's a chaos aspect to human behavior that is unpredictable, which is, I think, wonderful. I mean, even if it's something horrible, like an anarchic guy like Mal, he just wasn't figured into their original plan. And it's part of life in America today that somebody every few months is going to go into a public place with weapons and wreak havoc.
Well, let me ask you about Mal, this speed freak with apocalyptic visions. He heads to the mall with a machine gun and a shotgun and a bag full of ammunition and starts shooting up the place. He goes after his former employer at a tuxedo shop and then guns down every cop in sight. Do you think he's fairly typical of the people who go on rampages that we read about?
I can't say that I know what each individual story is. This story was triggered by a guy who went up on an interstate highway when his health insurance was not paying properly. Somebody who was, I think he had AIDS, and he unfurled a huge banner on the highway once he had gotten everybody looking at him. And he had a gun, of course. And then he killed himself on national television. This was a few years ago. I don't know what goes on in people's minds. I think that when one's self is so pressed down into conformity and sort of disappears, some people react by trying to bring all the energy back to them. And I think what's going on with Mal is that he's saying he's trying to become the center of the universe. He's trying to find some kind of transcendence or godhead or something on this night. And he actually achieves it almost for a split second.
Well, there's a passage near the end of the story that reflects on some of these things. Mal is, he's planning his final assault on the cops, and he's kind of hiding out in the woods. And I'm wondering if you could read that bit.
Okay. Let's see here. It couldn't because the crystal meth kept his sack of innards in a permanent state of fight or flight. He was redlining as intensely as a weasel caught in a trap. This was nothing new for Mal. His thinned hair was colorless, his teeth were loose, boils and scabs peppered his flesh. But he was still alive, because he knew how to pace himself. He had a tremendous urge to leap up, open his eyes, and run through the woods screaming, firing hot streams of bullets. But this was art to pace himself and wend his way through the suburban watering hole, killing, burning, scaring the piss out of everybody. Mal had spent years doing nothing, taking up space. As far as he was concerned, that's what everyone else did as well. No one wanted to admit it. Like dumb dinosaurs caught in a pool of tar, everyone pretended that it was all okay until it was too late, when they ended up on a hospital bed in a bad-smelling, semi-private room, surrounded by pathetic friends and family and selfish children. Everyone eventually realized how pointless the whole thing had been, how all the shopping, holiday get-togethers, school exams, job promotions, traffic jams, TV specials, distant wars, and sexual games had been for nada. Mal, despite his failure as tuxedo store employee, rack jobber, and son, was really alive right now. To be alive for 3 hours was more than most people got, and he was injecting his life into the hearts and souls and blood of all these good folk trying to stop him. They should be grateful, he thought. They're all walking in their sleep, and I'm the alarm.
You're really suggesting that the people who go postal or go mall, I guess we could say, are basically their lives have gone nowhere, and they imagine one final moment of glory, and it's going to be violent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not the first one to create a character like that. We live in a strange time when, unlike most generations before us, we have all our needs taken care of. And certainly in this country, we are Americans, the most powerful country on earth. The majority of people are middle class and white and have no real big problems in their lives. And yet, people seem kind of miserable from what I can tell, or they're angry about something. There's a lot of anger. And I don't know, I know the answers for myself personally, but I guess I'm writing about a condition. I'm not saying I have the answer, but I'm writing about something that that's visible to me.
Well, I have the sense that you are raging in this book. You seem to have a lot of anger, or maybe you're just translating it into your art.
Well, I like becoming other people without any consequences, of course. I mean, I can sort of be Mal for a night and rip through this mall without having to go to jail. And that's, in that way, it's related to what I do as an actor. I get to do it without consequence.
So actually there is something thrilling for you pretending to be Mal, at least for a little
bit. Oh, yeah. I would want to play Mal if there were a movie of this thing. I enjoy fantasies of power, and I enjoy all kinds of fantasies, but particularly fantasies of power and fantasies of sex are, for me, the most potent fantasies. I don't know what other people fantasize about. Maybe they fantasize about eating oatmeal. But me, I fantasize about power and sex.
Eric Bogosian, talking with Steve Paulson. Bogosian is an actor, playwright, and now with Mal, a novelist.
Had to go to the mall, the mall, for the blacktop, the parking space and all. Had to go to the mall, the mall, where that mass of humanity meets face to face and set a sanity. Show me the way to the mall.
Patty Larkin, At the Mall. Coming up, some lessons on how to save a dying city. And Jim Fleming, It's to the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
¶¶
East St. Louis. For years, it was a symbol of everything wrong with American cities. Houses were crumbling, poverty was rampant, and most commercial enterprises had given up on this old town along the Mississippi River. Then, in 1990, something remarkable happened. A few professors at the University of Illinois teamed up with a group of grassroots leaders to rebuild the city. Ever since, hundreds of college students have been traveling down to East St. Louis to work on various neighborhood projects. In return, they get college credit and some priceless lessons about life. Ken Reardon helped organize this project.
In 1956, East St. Louis was selected an All-American City by Look Magazine and the National Municipal League, a thriving industrial center, meatpacking, metal bending, aluminum production, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, everything looked good. Between 1960 and 1980, East St. Louis lost 75% of all of its businesses. 12,000 highly paid manufacturing jobs disappeared overnight, moved to the South and eventually overseas. With that, unemployment rate went from 6% to 29% by 1990. The poverty rate went from 12% to 42%. The city's budgetary situation just collapsed with the tax base contracting from $600 million to $150 million. They developed a municipal debt of almost $100 million, so much so that they had to eliminate all public services except for police and fire. They even had to eliminate trash collection from 1986 to 1992, and they also had to turn off their municipal streetlights because they couldn't pay their utility bill.
That was the one that I think really just blew me away when I heard it, that the streetlights weren't on because they couldn't pay the electricity.
So driving from one end of the city to the other, there were hand-painted signs wired to the traffic signals, which were now turned off, dark because they couldn't pay the utility bill, telling people to proceed with caution. All the street signs were stolen for their salvage value. 1,000 manhole covers were stolen for their salvage value. So around one elementary school in the middle of a neighborhood that we began our work in 1990, there were approximately 135 manhole covers missing around an elementary school serving kindergarten through sixth grade. And think about our children navigating those kinds of treacherous urban conditions. It was just horrifying.
And you said there was no trash collection either. What did they do with the trash?
People burned it. People took it to work. People sent it to school with their children in knapsacks, anything they could to try to get rid of it. They were paying the highest property taxes in the state of Illinois, but they weren't getting any services because with the departure of corporations, the tax base just wasn't sufficient. What happened was a group of women, church women, in 1964 were sitting at home in a public housing complex in East St. Louis, and they were watching the Democratic convention in Atlantic City. And there they heard the powerful words of Fannie Lou Hamer from the Freedom Democratic Party trying to get access to that convention. And they decided, this group of 12 girlfriends, that they were going to work together to turn their community around.
And so when you went there, your first point of contact was this group of 12 women?
Yes, which we referred to as the Blue-Haired Brigade. They were led by this now quite elderly, Miss Ciola Davis, and she invited us into the community on the condition that we met five simple requirements. One, they would, the residents of the city, through their organization, choose the issues to be worked on, not us or our funders at the university. Two, that they would be happy to work with us as long as they would be involved as active participants in the research and planning process from Jump Street, as they said. Three, they were not interested in, and the exact words they used was, another one-night stand, university coming in because it's popular for a semester to do some good, and then to leave just at the point where they've probably identified problems and probably not even solutions, and then leave the community to deal with just another brick on the wall. Fourth, they wanted us to open up our development office so that as plans were developed, they would be able to access regional funding sources that we were able to access because of our fundraising arm. And lastly, they wanted us to help them create a permanent nonprofit organization that could continue the work after we left.
And the response of the university to these demands, which are a little unusual for an academic department to face?
Well, I went back to my dean and I told her there was good news and bad news. The good news was that there was a hellacious group of faith-filled women who were about ready to turn their city around, and they were inviting us to be partners. She was very excited about that. I said the bad news is that they're a hell of a lot more serious about this work than we appear to be. And then I laid on the table the 5 points, which we've come to refer to in the project as the Sciola Accords, named after Miss Davis. She smiled. She says, it looks like they've worked with universities before, and she signed her name on the bottom. And that's how it began.
Wow. What about the students that you took down there? This is not the kind of semester project that most of them were probably looking forward to.
Absolutely not. In September of 1990, we went down to East St. Louis. As we approached the town, we smelled the burning garbage. As we got into the town, we saw no streetlights. It was an evening meeting at a settlement house, a 100-year-old settlement house. We had a hard time finding it. Even finding 12th Street meant you had to go to City Hall and count off 12 blocks.
Because all of the street signs were gone.
All the street signs. And then navigating through streets were missing manhole covers. So the students were just petrified. One said to me, went on to become the director of our state housing agency in Illinois, "Gee, Ken, what the hell can we do in a place like this? Look, the conditions are so desperate." At that point, we arrived at the front door, and there was Sciola and her women friends, who greeted us with great smiles and put their arms around us and invited us into the basement of the church. And they described how they had taken 3 arson-damaged buildings down with their own hands, dismantling the buildings, recycling the copper from the pipes, the wiring from the building, the lathing from the inside structure, and then generated $3,000 with the materials, the bricks that were used by decorative historic preservation people. They then held chicken dinners for a year to make their $3,000 grow to 5. They then went to Ralston Purina and asked for a matching grant in order for them to build the first playground in their neighborhood in 30 years.
And this is all before your project got anywhere near East St. Louis.
So looking around the room and realizing that 75-year-old grandmothers and great aunts and a couple of older retired railroad workers had made this happen, and then they showed us the playground. And then they said, with this, we're now ready to rebuild the entire neighborhood, and we need your help.
This sounds terrific, and I'm sure that there is more terrific to be heard about it. It's a leap to imagine that people smiled and said, "Oh, you're here. Welcome. Come into my house." What did happen? They must have gotten some, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" reaction.
Well, the fact that we were brought to them under the sponsorship of the auspices of a group of 12 women who were absolutely revered in this community, that even if they had questions about us, they were willing to give us the benefit of the doubt because we were friends of Miss Davis. And the amazing thing, we've been in East St. Louis now for 10 years. We've knocked on every door in the house, in the community many times. We've been in every church several dozens of times probably in the 10 years. It's just the enormous welcome. And for our students, absolutely life-transforming for many of them. They come into the community believing that some communities succeed and some fail because of pure effort, the Protestant work ethic. And all of a sudden they meet very poor African-American men and women who have done the hardest, the dirtiest, the most difficult work in our society, home health aides, school, teachers' assistants. They've worked in factories. They've done deliveries. They've worked in fast food places their whole lives, full-time jobs plus a second job. But because of economic decisions completely outside of their control, they were left behind in the new economy while our students were advantaged and privileged because of where they grew up. A simple twist of fate, as Bob Dylan would say. And this had an enormous impact. And after visiting these individuals in their homes and seeing what they had done to try to maintain their properties and to rebuild their neighborhoods in the face of, you know, daunting economic forces, our students would get completely captured. They would go through walls, jump over tall curbs, knock down buildings. And you say, what have we done? We did the first plan. It won the Best Plan of the Year award by the American Institute of Certified Planners. We all got our pictures taken with the vice president, who had a little spelling problem, Dan Quayle. We came back to East St. Louis. 30 agencies told us they wouldn't fund even the smallest project in our award-winning plan.
You had the plan, but the city agencies wouldn't respond?
City agencies wouldn't respond. Corporations wouldn't. Foundations. They viewed East St. Louis as a terminal case of urban decline. Let's just wait until the dust settles. They couldn't see any...
Could you at least show them photographs of the park that the women had built, of other projects that you had by this time?
Well, we did. It wasn't powerful enough. So Miss Davis put her arms around me at the meeting and said, "What did you expect, honey, a check?" I said, "Yes, I'm a middle-class white guy from New York City who went to an Ivy League school. I did expect a check." And she says, "Well, we're just going to have to work with the resources at hand." I said, "But that's the point. We don't have any." She says, "Look around the room. There are 80 residents, there are 40 of your students. This Saturday, let's implement the first step in our plan, environmental enhancement, by cleaning up the 10 worst lots in our neighborhood. So we did that. We recruited 50 students, they recruited 100 residents. We went down on a Saturday, we cleaned up mountains of trash from 10 lots, but we had no place to put it. Miss Davis then smiled and said, "See that nice yellow line down the middle of the street? Let's pile the garbage very neatly, 3 feet wide, 6 feet high, 100 yards down the middle of a county-owned street." Knowing that this would get the attention of the local civic leaders racing from the bluff towns down to their jobs in the gleaming central business district.
Driving
of
through
St. Louis,
the neighborhood.
Driving through
past the trash.
The Berlin Wall of garbage brought to you by Miss Davis. And just as we finished the last bag, mysteriously, Channel 7 News showed up. Somebody, we don't know who, we think we know, tipped them off, and there was a wonderful evening news story. University students, local religious leaders, and neighborhood activists break law to save neighborhood. And then they pan down this huge wall of black garbage bags. Uh-huh. The result was a grant from a local foundation. We were able to continue the cleanup. That led to volunteer paint-up scrape-ups of nearby houses.
Can I just ask what happened to that wall of garbage?
It was taken away within 2 days by the County Department of Public Works to a legal landfill. Mm-hmm. And so was all the additional trash that we collected in the same manner. The county decided that if the residents were willing to step up to the plate, they had to support that effort to enforce environmental rules and regulations.
And what was the next step then? What project did you take on with this student neighborhood?
Well, with all the garbage out, one of the ministers came back and said, "You know, now the whole street looks empty. We need to build a playground." So we went down, we designed a standard playground, 23,000 square feet. We presented it to a group of adults. An old reverend, Reverend Earl Dobbin, said, "You know, we need to get play experts involved in this." So he says, "We need kids to really look at these designs." So we came down the following Saturday. We picked up 15 kids in vans. They took us to their three favorite play spaces, an abandoned glass factory, a cemetery, and then finally a suburban school with a drop-dead beautiful playground. We brought them back to Reverend Dobbin's church. We gave them 75 feet of butcher block paper, and we said, "Here, draw your image of the ideal playground you'd like to have." And they created these amazing images in 15 minutes. We then took this mural, hung it up at three local elementary schools, a week at each, and gave all the kids at the school little smiling face decals to vote with the elements. And then we took life-size cutouts of the swings, of the flower beds, of all the play structures. And on a Saturday at Reverend Dobbin's church, we invited the kids to work with us in lifting these paper versions mm-hmm. of the elements of the playground and creating the actual physical site plan for the playground. So the Illinois Avenue Playground was built with $16,000 of donated materials from area churches, black contractors, supervising University of Illinois architecture and planning students. Today, when you get married in East St. Louis, that's where you have your wedding pictures taken.
At the playground.
At the playground. And it's been maintained now for 8 years. Following that, the residents that said, "You know, now the houses look pretty bad." And so we then used surplus paint from the university, sort of a bit humorous. Our colors are orange and blue.
Yes.
So we didn't want to use orange even in this holiday, Halloween season, so we tinted the blue a little bit, but it was still rather deep blue. And we painted 30 houses around the playground with neighborhood residents and students helping. It made quite a dramatic physical change. From there, the state treasurer of Illinois said, "Could you use some money? We collect $5 million a year in motor fuels tax. We put it in low-interest local bank accounts." The difference between what the state could negotiate and what the banks are willing to pay, we'll give to your local community organization to do rehab loans.
Now, this is a little different from your earlier effort that resulted in no check. All of a sudden, the state is coming to you and offering?
They called it the float, the difference between what the bank is willing to pay and what the state requires as their minimum interest return. That amount was $75,000 a year. And with that, we were able to purchase the materials so our architecture students would go in and assess a building that was at risk for decline or deterioration in the low-income neighborhood of Emerson Park, determine what the budget would be to rehab it. All the volunteer work would be done by our students under the supervision of black contractors who volunteered their time. The miracle was that in the middle of this, the state announced plans to build a light rail line from St. Louis Lambert Airport through the downtown of St. Louis, out to St. Clair County Airport. And the local political leaders had done a route to basically
avoid this neighborhood?
Four very, very poor black neighborhoods, and a route where, mysteriously, many of them just happened to own property, acquired, miraculously, the same month that the route was announced, that these members of the so-called Democratic organization
and
had.
And this was pointed out to various state and city planners, was it?
Indeed. And so the neighbors organized a massive rally, 300 people in the basement of the settlement house, calling for a route to go through the four poorest neighborhoods, supported by research done by our engineering, architecture, planning, and business school at the University of Illinois. We called it the night of the 1001 reasons. It was when the Dalmatian movie came out, why our route is better. So the mayor sat there after four or five reasons. He got up and said, I think I know where this train is going. Do you have a route? It was rerouted through the heart of our neighborhood. The other thing that happened is the light rail line gave East St. Louis's poor families who had no private transportation phenomenal access to living wage jobs out in the belt of manufacturing, warehouse, transportation, and even e-commerce businesses that have sprung up around Lambert Field in Missouri. So now 500 East St. Louis adults commute every morning out to very good jobs out at the airport.
It's wonderful.
And so we see 100 new homes built in East St. Louis in the last 3 years, done by a young black architect who's a graduate of our East St. Louis Action Research Project.
Ken Reardon was one of the founders of the East St. Louis Action Research Project. He now teaches city and regional planning at Cornell University. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Reclaiming Suburbia Show, number 34A. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can send us email through our website at www.wpr.org/book. We'd love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.